Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and welcome back our guest co-host, one of our favorite residents, Dr. Catherine Koh. Welcome, Catherine.
Oh, thanks, Adam. It's so great to be here again.
You know, we've got a remarkable interview today. We're going to be talking with Dr. Jimmy and Carol Haynes about the story of a heart transplant, an amazing story of courage and healing.
Yeah, definitely looking forward to the discussion and conversation with them.
But first, we're also going to have some really interesting research that matters. We're going to be able to talk about loneliness as a major risk factor for heart disease.
How strength training can help older adults actually live longer.
About primary care clinics and counseling for teens with depression.
And our last one is about the diabetes drug metformin and how it can lower the risk of heart disease better than other diabetic drugs such as sulfonylureas.
Well, this is really important research. Let's dive right in with this very first research that was appropriately published in the journal Heart. And it really is looking at loneliness as a risk factor for heart disease and stroke. And I think Christy and I have talked about on the show before about it being a risk factor, but this is a different sort of study.
What they were looking at is how loneliness and isolation can heighten the risk of heart disease and stroke. And it's almost counterintuitive because oftentimes we say that a high intense anxiety and stressful job can also make an increased risk for heart attack and stroke.
Yeah, and they looked at over 16 different research databases and found 23 studies with over 181,000 adults with over 4,000 heart attacks and death and 3,000 in strokes. And they combined all of this data. We sometimes call these meta-analysis or systematic reviews. And they found that loneliness or being socially isolated was an independent risk factor, 30% increased risk of a heart attack and 32% increased risk of a stroke. This is as large as some of the major established risk factors like smoking.
Right, exactly. So it was an observational study, so we can't make too firm of conclusions, but definitely interesting to know that perhaps being somewhat social can be good for your health.
Yeah, and I think that they lay a challenge out there about doing studies to see if interventions to boost social connections would lead to less heart disease and strokes. But I think one of the things that we may want to consider starting to do is starting to ask this when we have a Medicare physical or we have someone who at all ages comes in and is socially isolated to recognize that they are at higher risk at least, and we may want to at least open up that conversation.
Yeah, and even more question is now in our day of technology, would something like FaceTime be enough to substitute for an actual interpersonal connection?
Yeah, I think a phone call is always good, always good. Let's talk about our next research that matters, which is something that's probably also always good, which is strength training. And I know that you are physically very active. And matter of fact, you've just run not too long ago a Tar Heel 10 miler. You're pretty much of an endurance athlete.
I don't know. 10 miles, I guess so. It was a lot of fun. But this is more talking about strength training. So more lifting weights, even just light weights, and how that can help older adults to live a little bit longer. This was a study done by researchers at Penn State College of Medicine who found that older adults who met and did twice weekly strength training had lower odds of dying.
Yeah, it was really interesting. This was data from the 1997 to 2001 National Health Interview Study, really large representative sample of research. Then they published it in Preventive Medicine, and they found that these older adults who did this strength training, like you said, this kind of very, maybe sometimes not large amount, but strength training twice a week had a 46% lower odds of death for any reason and a 41% lower odds of heart death and 19% lower odds of dying from cancer. I'm not sure why it would have been lower odds of dying from cancer, but there's something about the physical activity that was, and this wasn't just physical activity, this was strength training that was really good.
Yeah, and these people who did the strength training were more likely to have other healthy habits, like engaging in aerobic exercise and abstaining from alcohol and tobacco.
And as I think back on the types of conversations, we were just talking about having conversations about loneliness at physical examinations. How often do we talk about strength training? We talk about physical activity, but we don't really talk about strength training. That's maybe something, again, we have to change as our colleagues, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
There didn't seem to be a lot of downside, perhaps unless you did too much. If you went out there and tried to, I remember there's a recent fad where people go to these gyms and they're kind of encouraged to do activity. And the instructors said, well, you men out there, you can start with 35-pound weights, and the women, you can start with 25. And I'm like,
whoa,
I'm not starting with 35. I'm heavy. About, you know, 20 is good enough for me in terms of where I'm going to start with. So we don't want to encourage injury.
Sure, and I guess always important to have a conversation with your physician about whether or not that's something that you can safely incorporate into your lifestyle.
Speaking of conversations, Catherine, this next research that matters is about teens who are depressed, and they come into the clinic. And I know, like myself, you see these teens in your clinic.
Definitely. This study was published in the Journal of Pediatrics out of Kaiser Permanente. And as you mentioned, these teens, they come into our clinics and we'll sometimes diagnose them with depression. And they tend to be less open to starting a medicine like an SSRI or an antidepressant. And so this study looked at how else can we best support these teens and help them get treatment and potentially even cure from their depression.
And I think one of the challenges is accessing the mental health care system. And so it's for so many people, it's like in the cloud and it's oftentimes a separate system. And here, they sounds like that they were trying to incorporate some support perhaps within the primary care team. And they looked at a 5 to 9 week program where they were provided access to counselors to do what's called cognitive behavioral therapy. And half of the group of the 212 teens got the therapy and one half did not get this particular therapy or maybe got a prescription without the therapy. And they found that those who got the therapy recovered much quicker.
Yeah, this type of therapy that they were talking about is something called cognitive behavioral therapy, where it helped the teens challenge unhelpful or depressive thinking and then replace those beliefs with more realistic and positive thoughts.
They recovered 7 weeks faster, those who got the program, the teens who didn't participate. After 6 months, 70% of those teens had recovered, only 43% of the teens not in the program. So if you have a depressed teen or you're a depressed teen listening, we would encourage you to go see your primary care doctor, get enrolled, see a mental health professional. Cognitive behavior therapy has really great success. It's
definitely
good starting place with doesn't sound like many side effects.
Nope.
Let's talk about our last research that matters, and it's about diabetes and drugs that have been around for a fair amount of time called metformin or glucophage, and its relationship to perhaps an older drug that has been around for a longer period of time, which you probably had not had a lot of practice, but you probably have some patients who've been on it, Catherine, called sulfonylureas. These are some of the older medicines that our patients were on before they were on metformin.
Yeah, in this study out of Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, they actually did another one of those meta-analyses where they looked at patients who were taking metformin and sulfonylureas. It spanned multiple continents, and there were 22 mostly observational studies lasting longer than 2 years. And ultimately, they concluded that metformin is probably the best first-line therapy for diabetes.
Yeah, this was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. And I think what's interesting about the drug is that it seems to control the blood pressure as well, but certainly with less overall side effects. And the low blood sugars that came about with some of the sulfonylureas, you don't see that as much. At least I'm not sure if I've ever seen that really with the metformin. It can happen. And so you can lower it more safely without having the side effects. We do have to sometimes put people on both drugs to keep them off insulin. But I think it suggests that if you have someone who is on one of the older ones, they should certainly talk about, are they a candidate for being on the metformin? That would be a reasonable conversation.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, that'll conclude the Research Matters portion of the show. We're going to take a short break, Catherine. When we return, we're going to be talking with Dr. Jimmy and Carol Haynes about a remarkable story of courage and healing. The story of a heart transplant. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koch. Today on Conversations, Catherine, we have the great pleasure of talking with Dr. Jimmy and Carol Haynes about the story of a heart transplant, a really remarkable story of courage, health, and healing. Welcome, Jimmy and Carol.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You know, we are so really blessed to have you all here and sharing with us some remarkable stories. But first, tell us a little bit about yourself and your own backgrounds. If we were to roll back the clock 10 years, what would you have been doing?
10 years, I would have been practicing as a periodontist. And
you were just going into the hospital then.
Well, that was for the bypass surgery.
Which is when everything really started going downhill.
So you were just happy-go-lucky, taking care of patients in private practice in the community, and you got ill.
Didn't even get ill. Yeah. He had shoulder pain that was diagnosed as some kind of an orthopedic thing.
And I got steroid injections in my shoulder, which didn't help, obviously. And eventually, I saw the cardiologist. And
was someone I work with. So the only reason he really ended up seeing a cardiologist is because I did genetic research in cardiovascular diseases at Duke. So one of my best friends is a cardiologist. His cardiologist had said, everything's fine. And she said, you know what? He should really have a stress echo. Expected everything to be perfectly normal. And
then I had a cardiac cath.
Right.
And they wouldn't let me leave.
Yeah. I'm wondering if, Jimmy, you wouldn't mind sharing with our listeners what it was like to have that stress echo. What does that entail? What did they make you do?
Yeah, we make it sound like we order it all the time and we don't really think about what someone who's experiencing it. And that we think of it as something kind of easy. Was it easy or were you worried?
Well, it's easy when you start and they increase the incline and the speed.
So you were on a treadmill?
Treadmill, yeah. And they make you go until you can't go anymore. I mean, it's not that bad.
Was there anything that you experienced that made it that you couldn't go anymore?
I mean, you can only run so fast for so long. You know, I didn't experience any angina during the stress echo. And it was just that my cardiologist saw something in the results that indicated that I should have a cardiac catheterization, which I had maybe a week later.
What did they tell you? Were you guys together when they came out and said, you know what, I know you didn't have pain, but I don't like this?
What she said was, we just saw the tiniest little thing. It was not a big deal, but basically at Duke, they cath a lot of people. And so she suggested he have the cath. And it happened to be Memorial Day weekend. He had it the Friday before we were leaving for the beach. He thought he'd go in, he'd have this cath, we'd drive to the beach, and everything would be fine. So he goes in to have the cath. And she had said to me, my friend Dr. Shaw had said to me before that, the most they were expecting is maybe one vessel, do a stent, everything would be fine. And they go in, and she came out. She was ashen white, because she said he had extensive, severe four-vessel disease. He couldn't leave the hospital.
They wouldn't let me leave the hospital, yeah.
So until he had a bypass.
Bypass.
So you had a bypass a short time later. Life is now changing at a rapid pace.
Well, before that, during the bypass, he had an event and left him with a huge ejection fraction deficit.
So your heart... Something happened to your heart during the procedure, which essentially stunned, killed a lot of your heart.
Correct.
Which is potentially a risk of a procedure, which you're trying to give the heart new blood and new life.
Yes.
Probably a rare event, but it could happen.
So in 2005, so that was when he had the bypass, and then a few months later had an ICD implanted.
Yeah, the ejection fraction was 25% after the bypass surgery.
And just for our listeners, ejection fraction is the percentage of blood that the heart can squeeze out in any given squeeze. And normal is about 60%. So at 25%, that's a pretty severe drop.
And when you get down to less than 10%, it's not so compatible with long living.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Well, only because he had been in such good shape before, which is one of the reasons that they didn't catch the symptoms before, because he had been a runner and had been in such good shape. But then after the bypass and after the ICD, he went back to running and did everything possible. I think that's the biggest message, is that you have these things happen and you have to just not give up. You want to get back to being healthy. And he worked really, really hard at getting back to being healthy, and was healthy for another eight years.
So you're, again, kind of recovering from a very difficult coronary artery bypass surgery that is complicated by heart failure. You really have come a long way. And fast forward, when did you notice that things perhaps were no longer, to use the term, kosher?
running was getting more difficult. There were some days where you just felt like you hit the wall. It wasn't until 2013 I went to a meeting in Charlotte, and on the way back I was getting very short of breath. So I called Carol and told her that I wasn't feeling well, and I would be home in an hour or something like that. And when I got there, she took one look at me and called 911. At that point, I was turning a little gray.
Not a good color.
That's not a good color.
He couldn't breathe at all. Yeah. We got in the car to go to, I was going to take him to the emergency room, and knew that that wasn't going to happen.
And Carol, what we have in front of us is this amazing outline of all of the events surrounding Jimmy's experience and heart transplant. And gosh, that must have been so scary for you. Walk us through what you were thinking and how you best supported him.
It was very scary. So he had several, between that time when he was diagnosed with pneumonia and until he had the transplant, there were all these different times when he was home, but he couldn't breathe. And all night long, he would be just trying to breathe. And it was the scariest thing. What do you do? You can't call 911 every day, and he would say, no, I'm fine. And it was horrible. Mm-hmm. It was extremely stressful, but we did the best we could.
So, you know, again, it's really quite amazing that you are experiencing the things that are complications of disease processes, for which at some point in time, most people think, or at least as doctors, we probably think we're just going to be managing with medications. We continue to manage with medications. But at some point in time, clearly something changed, and someone must have told you, or you told someone, this isn't working. What happened? What changed that ultimately said, we better think about, is it possible to get a transplant?
Well, I went in for I saw the heart failure clinic and transplant team, and went in for another cardiac catheterization, and that one showed severe right side heart failure. And it was at that point that medications, nothing was going to work except for the transplant.
But leading up to that, the reason he had the cath again was because the fluid that he had had on his lungs from pneumonia never went away, and it was weeks and weeks of not being able to breathe and fluid there. And that's why, when they decided that enough was enough. And then things went downhill rapidly.
Very quickly. Yeah.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're actually going to pick up and talk about what happened when it went downhill and what it was like to start thinking about a heart transplant. And also living with a heart transplant. We're talking with Dr. Jimmy and Carol Haynes about the story of a heart transplant. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Cope.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Coe. We've been talking to Dr. Jimmy and Carol Haynes about the story of a heart transplant. And before the break, we were discussing sort of the initial events that Jimmy experienced that led to his heart not pumping and squeezing as well as it should. And right before the break, you left us with a cliffhanger, Carol, and said that was before everything went downhill. Pick us up from that point in perspective. What went downhill and what were signs and symptoms that Jimmy was experiencing?
Well, the funny thing is that it's not until we looked at pictures later on after his heart transplant, when he was pink again, that we looked back 6 months before, 2 months before. The pictures of him, he was gray. But I guess when you live with someone every day, you don't quite notice when something like that changes. But he was a horrible color. And he couldn't breathe and was having trouble really just even walking around. And when he was in the hospital after the cath that showed that he had severe pulmonary hypertension and that his bypass grafts were fine, so it wasn't that. It was clearly that the heart failure was towards the end. I was very, very fortunate that my friend Dr. Svati Shah was able to come into the hospital room and tell me and him together before the heart transplant team came in the next day, because she came in and said heart transplant, and I cried and cried. It was just horrifying to think that it had come to that. It wasn't that it was so unexpected. It's just when someone actually says the words.
So, Jimmy, what was it like for you to be told that you needed a heart transplant? A professional who's taking care of patients. You had some, I guess, knowledge about heart transplants, about how accessible it might be. What were you thinking?
I guess I had faith in the system. I tried to remain positive, and considering the alternative, transplant looked pretty good. Didn't want to look back at what might have been or could have been. I just wanted to move on. When you're feeling as bad as I did, there's only one way to go.
How long did it take to find a donor?
About 2.5 weeks.
Wow.
But that was because, part of that was because I was on a cardiac pump and milrinone, which jumped me up to the top of the list. You can only be on milrinone for a certain period of time. It's one of those drugs that will initially, it will keep you alive, but eventually it will kill you.
So you were down to potentially weeks or at the most months that you would live without a transplant.
Yes.
Right. And once they put in the cardiac pump, you have to be in the ICU. So he was in pretty much immobilized, because they put this thing in your groin and you can't move that leg or that side of your body, and you can only have your head raised 20 degrees. So you're essentially lying flat for a long time.
And was he in that position for the whole 2 weeks?
Two and a half weeks. Yes.
Okay. What they said was his blood type was O, so it's the universal donor, but not a universal recipient. But he's also not very large, so he could get a female heart or a male heart. He had a wider range of hearts, but anyone who was higher on the list than him, when an O heart came in, would get that first. Not to mention that at his age, Duke is one of the places in the country that takes B hearts. He wasn't going to get a young heart. But then he didn't need a young heart, because he didn't need to live 40 more years. So there's a lot of things that made it happen in the 2.5 weeks.
Well, you know, we think about things that we wouldn't have thought about 20 years ago today, and I know that people are doing bypasses on people in their 90s, and so doing heart transplants, if it can work. You wake up one day, you've had a heart transplant. Tell us one of the first things you remember after waking up. What was it like?
I had that intubation tube, and when you first regain consciousness, that thing is so aggravating, and I was just sitting there grinding on that tube, and every time somebody would come in the room, I would motion, get this out, get this out. And so finally when they got that out, I felt fine. I mean, I was not in any pain. I could breathe. It was a world of difference.
And what about psychologically? Was there any change, or did you just assume you're the same person, and so I'm ready to get out?
I was ready to get out. I guess I see the heart as a pump. You know, I don't buy into the Valentine's type things of the heart and that. It's maybe my training or something made me more objective about the procedure and no, I didn't feel any different. I didn't expect to feel any different.
He's the most positive person in the world. He made them get him while he was still in the ICU just a few days after when they finally took most of the machines off. He made him walk him around the ICU, dragging the machines that they hadn't quite taken out yet.
That's amazing. And you guys just recently passed a 3-year anniversary of the heart transplant. Is
yes.
that correct? Carol, what was going through your mind on the day that Jimmy received the heart?
I always thought it would work. I don't know why I thought it would work, but I thought if he got a heart, he'd be okay. And the surgery part, I actually went home because I'd spent the whole night in the hospital with him while they were waiting to recheck blood types and make sure it was going to go forward. I went home. I tried to go to sleep, but the hospital called me every 30 minutes to give me updates, so I couldn't really sleep. But I did stuff around the house. It was when the surgery was over, when the surgeon called and said, come back, everything is good, that was really hard because I was in the ICU waiting room waiting, and they would come out with all the terrible things that were actually happening at the time, because there's a lot of post-surgical issues that come up that I wish I hadn't known, because all it was stress when it was fine in the end.
So you have a heart transplant, and we know it's been 3 years. What's it like for you, Jimmy, living with a heart transplant? I imagine from hearing and knowing, and I should tell our listeners, we've known each other for a good number of years, that you are this really incredibly optimistic and humble. People wouldn't know, but you know. Do you feel different month to month, year to year, or do you feel like you are just now part of anyone else's kind of that other people have, even though you know you're not?
I really don't feel any different, I don't think, than anybody else that's healthy at my age.
But people look at you when they hear you have a heart transplant, you know that they go, wow, right? That's
Yes, that's true. I guess they think it was a very traumatic experience and a terrible thing to go through. But again, it really is, I mean, it's traumatic, I guess, but you sleep through that.
And you exercise a lot now.
Tell
our listeners what a typical day for you. And listeners should also know that you are an amazing artist, as are you, Carol. Your house is filled with amazing art. Tell us, though, what a typical day might be for you now.
Well, today I got up and I walked for 30 minutes. Then I lifted some weights for about 30 minutes. And then I have some stretching exercises I do. Then we put the bikes on the car and rode for about 50 minutes in Chapel Hill.
Wow. So that's quite the exercise regime.
Well, luckily we were retired. So
the thing is
that
not a day goes by that I wake up every morning and I thank that family that donated the heart. The fact is, it's a gift that is just that someone was in a position that their loved one died and that they were willing to make life happen for someone else. It's the most incredible gift you can get. And we just decided at the time we would not take it for granted in any way and that we would do what we could to honor that heart and live life to the fullest, do what we could, and not ever think that it's something that you take for granted.
And it sounds like you would be very encouraging of all of our listeners to consider being organ donors.
Absolutely.
And around the country and internationally. And I know on license says that you can do this, and you don't think about it, but your experience really shows the potential life-saving potential.
When I was in the waiting room, there was two people received the lung transplant. So I in the cardiopulmonary area, it was me and the two families of the two lungs. And then upstairs, there were the two kidneys and the liver. So I know of six families in the hospital at the same time as we were there from one person.
Wow, that's quite an amazing impact that person was able to
have.
If you both could leave our listeners with one final thought or take-home message from today's conversation, what would that be?
I guess if you're facing something like this, I would just tell them, remain positive. Have trust in the people that you're dealing with in the system, and things will eventually work out for you.
And that family and friends are really important. Having support from my friends, from our family, made it so much easier to deal with the adversity.
I think we have to thank both you, Dr. Jimmy and Carol Haynes, for sharing what is truly a remarkable, even though you say perhaps for you it's just part of life, but I think for our listeners and for us as professionals, it is a remarkable story. And for both of you, because it's a journey you've taken together, and we thank you, Carol, for coming in and willing to share. And we celebrate a three-year anniversary, and we look forward to strength and many more such celebrations for you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Jimmy and Carol Haynes about the story of a heart transplant, a really remarkable story of courage, health, and healing. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, we'll spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And Catherine, if a listener would like us to address an issue on an upcoming show, all they have to do is send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question today that kind of makes me dizzy.
I recently started getting dizzy pretty frequently, and when I asked my doctor about it, he said I have something called benign paroxysmal positional vertigo. He said it would probably go away on its own, but I'm a little worried that something's going on in my head. Is there anything I can do to take more action?
And I think that worried about something more going on in your head is them being concerned that perhaps there's something else underlying, like a mass or something scary, more
Let's
sinister.
Use the C word, cancer.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
I just go right for the jugular there. I mean, everyone's like, we can talk about, and we call benign vertigo, we call BPV. But you know what? When we say things like benign, even that word doesn't sound benign. How many syllables do those words have? So it's really complicated. And, it's a fancy way of saying you get dizzy. And it seems to be related to position.
Yep. There are certain exercises that someone can do to try and help see if it gets any better, something called an Epley maneuver, and there are great YouTube videos online. If that isn't working, again, time to have a discussion with your doctor. Just let them know, and perhaps they could send you to someone who is a vestibular physical therapist, so help with rehab, or perhaps do need to look to see if something else is going on.
Yeah, this is one of those things that it sounds easy, but it's not so easy. And I had an elderly patient recently who this started happening. And, of course, when it happens in someone elderly and they haven't had it before, one gets really concerned that someone's having a stroke or tumor, as you mentioned. And we had to do a tremendous amount of workup, including even hospitalization happened. And yet we then came down and figured out that this is probably what it is. But that doesn't mean that it's benign in terms of it. It's debilitating to have these symptoms and then worried that you're going to fall and break a hip or other sorts of things. We should really perhaps do a show on this at one point in time. And even think about all the different causes of it, including medications, because medications could cause these things too. Daniel, what's our very next house call?
My wife recently had a kidney stone. It passed without any complications, but after seeing her in so much pain, both of us want to be proactive about preventing them if we can. Are there things we should do or not do to protect ourselves from kidney stones down the road?
Well, we know and we've heard from many that having a kidney stone is perhaps the only thing that could compete with having a child.
That is what I have heard as well.
And that can be really incredibly painful. So we're really sorry that you had a kidney stone, but kidney stones are pretty common.
Kidney stones are very common, and perhaps the easiest way to know exactly the best way to prevent one from happening is if they were lucky enough to actually catch the kidney stone after it passed. You can send that in for analysis and
see. How do they do that?
So a little strainer, pee into a strainer.
Like one of those tea strainers.
Yep, exactly, yeah. And see if you catch a little rock.
Yeah.
And then submit it to the lab to analyze exactly what it's made of, and perhaps dietary changes. Definitely drinking lots of water can be helpful.
Yeah, this is one of those things that, again, it seems like it's obvious on the surface, but again, it's complicated because you could have different types of stones that may be treated differently. Also, there are sometimes some medicines that people could benefit from to be on if the urine is too alkaline or acidic, and we have to change the pH, the chemistry of the urine, to make it less likely. And then we talked about medications.
Yeah, some medications can make people more prone to forming kidney stones.
A complicated question with lots of dimensions here. We would encourage you to go see your primary care provider, maybe a urologist if you need to, and have this conversation, because you could hopefully prevent them from happening in the future. Daniel, what's our last house call?
My brother used to suffer from an opioid addiction. He's been clean for a few years, but he recently tore his meniscus, and the orthopedist said he would probably need surgery. He doesn't want to get the surgery because he's afraid if he gets pain medication in recovery, he might start wanting to use opioids again, but he's having trouble getting around on his bad knee. Do you have any suggestions?
Boy, this is a really tough situation.
Very tough.
I'm really, really sorry, and thank you for sharing it. What kind of thoughts just come to mind, Catherine?
It's definitely a conversation that needs to happen. If the knee is impacting your brother's life so much that he's not able to do the things that he loves and enjoys and is able to be fulfilled, then perhaps looking at a repair is not out of the question. And nowadays, our pain specialists are really good at alternative modalities for pain. They can do a localized nerve block in the groin where it numbs up the rest of the leg, maybe requiring less pain medicines after surgery.
And even potentially a spinal procedure and perhaps an indwelling catheter of some sort that can give you long acting for several days of pain relief. Sometimes just anti-inflammatory agents. And I've even seen a conversation where there is a risk of relapse, but they'll do it for 7 days. And so they might say you can take it 3 times a day for every other day, and then 2 times and 1 time. And they do a very strict regimen. And again, this is not something we take lightly because we don't want to have you go through relapse.
Yep.
Well, that'll conclude the house calls today. And we want to thank all of you for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Follow us online at yourhealthradio.org, Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and of course our guests, Dr. Jimmy and Carol Haynes. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heels station.